Welcome to West of Centre, the Birmingham Fabians podcast. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is the chair of Birmingham Fabians, Luke John Davis.
Hello.
Also with us, first-time guest is Fred Gridrod, and Fred was Labour PPC for Mid Worcestershire. Hello, Fred.
Hi.
Those of you who listened to our predictions episode will know that Labour had a much better night here, as well as across the country, than we anticipated. So in this podcast, we'll discuss why that was and what Labour should aim to do in the West Midlands now. Now, Fred, it wasn't your first time as a PPC, was it?
No, I've stood before. I stood in the 2005 general election all the way down in Southend in Essex.
What was different in Mid Worcestershire this time to what it was like in 2005?
Really interesting kind of comparison, really. So in 2005, I was selected about 15 months before, so it was a long, gruelling campaign, lots and lots of activity, real focus of building campaign teams, canvassing as much as we could, being a kind of figurehead of the local campaign for an awful lot of time, very exhausting time. Whereas this time, it was 6 weeks in, you know, and out again, do as much damage to the Conservatives as I could in that time, and then, you know, finished, really.
Mid Worcestershire, even in a good election, probably wouldn't be on a Labour target list, I'm guessing.
For those of you that know, Worcestershire is it includes the kind of the main towns are both Evesham and Droitwich, and then lots and lots of little villages, you know, around them. I was disappointed to find that Inkbarrow, which is the Archers is based on, is actually over the border in the Redditch constituency, so I couldn't even claim that.
That's a shame.
Mid Worcestershire.
How do you find it fighting in an unwinnable seat like that? Do you find it a bit dispiriting?
No, quite the opposite. I mean, it was fantastic. I mean, I really did have a great time. Ain't because there isn't the kind of pressure and the focus on you to deliver something other than fly the flag, really, and build the local Labour Party. And I guess the real agenda for us was about setting a platform for Labour to start winning council elections, which are possible in that constituency in 2019. But really, you know, having a lot of fun, getting in the papers, getting on the local radio and taking part in hustings and just generally kind of raising awareness of Labour's manifesto and also raising awareness of what the Conservatives plan to do so that the Member of Parliament is held accountable.
How do you find taking part in hustings? Because I think if I was a candidate, that's the part I would be terrified on, because you get questions on everything and not just the national stuff, just really local issues like local library cuts or something. Like, how do you prepare for anything like that?
That's one of the real differences between 2005 and now. In 2005, I knew my local stuff really, really well because I've been doing it for 15 months. This time around, I didn't have a clue on some of the issues. So it was a bit nerve-wracking and it was challenging. But I took part in two hustings debates and they both went really, really well. Lots of concern about public services, lots of kind of questions about local development challenges. Interestingly, not as much on Brexit as certainly, you know, I'd been expecting. You know, some real detailed stuff about local transport planning and things like that, which again, I kind of had to conjure up some kind of waffle that then enable me to get a, you know, to at least sound credible whilst admitting I didn't know the answer.
Sounds like the Brexit position, actually.
I mean, one thing was interesting. So on the Droitwich hustings, it was the Green candidate, myself, the Liberal Democrat, and the Conservative, Nigel Huddleston, who's now, you know, the victor and the current MP. Good, really good discussion around wrestling with issues. But the Evesham hustings was the UKIP candidate who didn't turn up to Droitwich sent a delegate instead, and it changed the whole tone. I really didn't like, you know, this idea of UKIP being on there, and we were unable to challenge them on the false stuff that they were saying because of the format of the hustings. And it's interesting how there is a kind of reasonable, rational debate amongst certain parties, and why, you know, that some of the kind of far right parties are, you know, which I think UKIP is, do really kind of spoil those things.
Just because of what you were saying in the hustings that you couldn't challenge, or because you didn't feel you could talk about the things that they said in their manifesto?
Yeah, a bit of that. I mean, I think again in 2005 we didn't realise the threat that UKIP were and what would happen if they went unchecked, and a lot of us kind of saw them as equals in terms of candidates, and they participated in hustings then. At the time, I didn't participate in hustings with the British National Party candidates, but UKIP were there, and actually, you know, I look back at 2005 and realise that I didn't give them as hard a time, as much scrutiny as I should have done in those things. So then seeing what's happened since, you're left with a bit of a taste in my mouth.
It's part of that, and I'm trying to remember the history, but it's part of that because in 2005 UKIP was seen as almost a vehicle to take away Tory votes away from the Conservatives, yeah. So maybe we, just for partisan reasons, didn't mind them being there.
Well, yeah, and I guess we didn't expect what they would end up doing with their kind of views and how they would, you know, skew the European debate, particularly in such a way that resulted in the really disastrous outcome, in from my perspective. I mean, one of the interesting things as well that perhaps I should say, as a candidate in a seat that we're not as likely to win, you can kind of pitch your, you know, on certain things slightly off tangent. And, you know, I'm a committed Remainer, and I was able to kind of, you know, really stand up in those hustings and state that I was committed to remaining in the European Union and maybe wasn't as managed perhaps as some, you know, you might be in a seat that we needed to win.
That's right. We won't tell Jeremy, it's fine. Yeah, because you were in a seat that maybe we weren't expected to win, does that mean you spend most of your time campaigning in that seat, or do you try and help out other local marginals?
Half of my time, campaigning time, was in the constituency, and the other half was committed to the nearest seat we must, you know, key seat, target seat, and that seat was Northfield in Birmingham. And a lot of the time I would be helping there, and then kind of the next day I'd be down in Evesham or Droitwich. I think in the future, had we known how well we'd do on that night, in hindsight, we might have been able to do more to help Worcester, where we had an excellent candidate in Joy Squires and came very, very close to getting rid of the Conservative there.
I suppose we all kind of spent a lot of our time in three quite different seats, because you, LJ, you spent quite a bit of time campaigning for Emma Reynolds in Wolverhampton. I, as regular listeners will know, spent most of my time campaigning for Steve McCabe in Selly Oak. Hashtag stick with Steve. I think how it felt in the campaign, I know a few people in Steve's campaign felt like this, is it kind of felt a bit like being in a very defensive by-election, at least it did at the start of the campaign. One of those kind of by-elections where you're hoping that your vote will stick around until polling day, and you're hoping a lot of it won't peel off. And then we ended up with a majority of 15,000, which was bigger than a majority in the equivalent seat in 1997. Places like Birmingham Northfield, where I know you were also quite active, Richard Burden increased his majority. Preet Gill and Edgbaston got a bigger majority than Gisela Stewart ever got in 20 years. I know we said on our predictions episode, we got 7 out of 10 right, by the way. We got 70% of the seats right in Birmingham. As usual, we kind of missed out the three that were quite important. Yeah.
All the ones we thought wouldn't change didn't change, and all the three we thought did, didn't. It's certainly at the start, it felt like Stoke, when I was campaigning in Stoke in February. It felt like a marginal. It felt like we were desperately trying to cling on to our core vote and hope that it would be enough to see us through. Even on the day itself, I was over in Wolves North East on the polling day, and the first door knocking session we did about 10:30 in the morning, working class council estate kind of area, I was sort of feeling my worst fears would be confirmed. I mean, we were going round DOTV, right, Labour voters. On the first round we did, we had 6 for Labour, 7 for the Tories, and 8 wouldn't say. And then we changed areas to a more middle class area. Sorry, it was a completely different picture. Everybody that we knocked was voting Labour. We were getting people coming out onto the street going, "Why aren't you knocking on my door? I vote Labour as well." It felt like a completely different election. It was ever so strange, but I think actually what it was, our techniques, if you like, of canvassing and getting out the vote fell down, in that when we were doing most of our identifying of the vote, it was that phase when Theresa May was on top, where everybody was sort of thinking there was going to be a landslide for the Tories, it was going very badly for us. And the campaign shifted, and halfway through it completely changed. But when we came to get out the vote, we were still looking at that, and we were also looking at in certain areas around here, the white working class areas that we thought we needed to put work into to keep hold of, and as you say, try and stop them peeling off. And if you look at the election results, they did peel off. But we replaced them with a whole raft of new people that we had no idea were even going to vote, and particularly young people, weren't picking up that they were going to vote for us, because we didn't expect that they'd vote for anyone. So we didn't go and knock on their doors and have a conversation with them.
Going back to my Mid-Worcestershire experience, which it was an interesting one. So I got the best result in Mid-Worcestershire for Labour since 1997. And I was very surprised at this. Not because I'd always thought we'd reclaim second place. We hadn't had second place since 2005, because the Lib Dems had come second in 2010. And UKIP becomes second in 2015. So we got 12,000, so we put on 5,000 more voters. I was really kind of quite surprised. I thought, you know, we might get to 9. That's what I'd hoped for. But it really did turn out that, you know, and whilst this is, you know, there's lots of kind of irrelevancies about this because it is such an unwinnable seat. What seemed to me that happened is that the Lib Dem, any remnant of the Lib Dem vote came all the way over to us. Mm. I mean, they really were in those kind of seats where you'd expect them, where a lot of people were saying vote Lib Dem in those seats to make sure that pro-Remain kind of looks like the new European had recommended people vote, you know, Lib Dem or Green in those kind of seats, because to make sure that people's dissatisfaction with Brexit was registered in that way. It didn't happen. They all came over to us. So those kind of places, and I think that's really true about Worcester, for example, where suddenly you've got, you know, and certainly Leamington and Warwick and Leamington, where really that clearly is a seat that was a Remain seat in the referendum.
Yeah, that's
and
right. That really, for the 2015 general election.
That's really where that kind of really translated. And we see that all across the south, particularly.
I think, Warwick and Leamington is definitely the Midlands equivalent of Canterbury or Kensington, isn't it? It's what do you mean that's Labour? That makes no sense.
That's Harold Macmillan's old seat. I mean, you know.
We expected to lose seats in Coventry back when you said, you know, that period where the polls really showed us so far behind. If you put that into the electoral calculators, you would have seen we lost two of the three Coventry seats. Yeah. We expected to lose all three Stoke seats. We expected to lose two of the Wolverhampton and Dudley North, the remaining Dudley. So it's it really is quite interesting, you know, that we didn't lose any of those seats. Mm. And I think the Northfield experience is really useful on this. So we put on voters in Northfield when we were exactly in that defensive phase. And indeed, in those kind of times, that kind of first period, we were going round and it was saying, we're not voting for you because of your leader or because we don't like this or position on Brexit.
Mm. I've always voted Labour put.
And yeah, indeed. Long-term Labour loyalists that. We either lost that and replaced it somewhere else. I think the dementia tax stuff pulled a lot of that back in. Mm. And then I think we put on these people, like you say, who hadn't voted for us before. I think suddenly all the Lib Dems and Greens, which weren't that many in Northfield, came into us, but also younger voters as well. But the Mori kind of breakdowns clearly show that the 25 to 40s, I think 25 to 45s, yeah. I think, all, you know, we won that group as well.
Yeah, everyone focused on what the dementia tax would do to pensioners. But I think that also that 25 to 45 graphic, a large chunk of them are depending on inheriting a house.
Right? Yep.
It's the only way they're getting on the homeowners ladder, right? Yeah. That one managed to put off everyone, not just the pensioners.
And the interesting thing is, it's really affected Theresa May's standing amongst older voters personally. Her favourability ratings have gone from something like plus 45 to, I think, plus 4 amongst those older voters.
And I think that's the thing. So I think we kept tranches of vote that we were expecting to lose. Mm. We kept them. And I guess that there was one thing. So my opponent was very much trying to be Mr. Nice Guy. And I think, you know, he genuinely is a nice guy. But he really kind of wanted to present himself as this conciliatory figure who actually wasn't really taking the Theresa May strong and stable lines. He was taking, you know, a bit of strong and stable, but it's all about the economy and the Conservatives. You know, he was, you know, I mean, he's part of the old Conservative Remainer crowd. I think he's got links with Nicky Morgan and Anna Soubry and others. But he was very much trying to say, look, we need Philip Hammond out here, kind of, please, please bring Philip Hammond out and we'll be all right, kind of stuff.
Mm.
And he tried to do that rather than push home on that.
Just to go kind of slightly off a tangent, that mayoral election, I think, is very, very important because we talked about how bad the polls were, you know, a few weeks before the election. Well, actually, the local election results were stonkingly bad.
Yeah.
Mm. And the mayoral election, which, I mean, we predicted, listeners, on the Birmingham Fabians, but no one else saw coming. And the fact that in Selly Oak here, there were 63 votes between Labour and the Tories in Selly Oak. And I wonder if that is a bit of almost like a coalition where, because the dementia tax means that many people don't then go voting Tory, we kept more of our core vote than we thought we would. And also, probably especially in places like Selly Oak, the student vote is a bit of a factor.
I think you're right. And one of the things, I think the real warning from that is that where we can get good turnouts, you know, I think the mayoral election overall turnout was 25% across the...
Yeah.
Where we get good turnouts, we've got the opportunity to really take on the Conservatives and really win and win well. Where it goes down, where we start to see the segmenting of people not voting, we're in real problems. And that means that next year's local council elections, which I'm really optimistic about because I think they're going to be held at a time when, you know, the Conservative Party are going to be really unpopular nationally. If we don't get the turnout we need, we could find ourselves in problems that really we should be avoiding.
Mm. And actually, there was some interesting analysis of the turnout figures from a sophologist on Medium. I can't remember her name, but she said that the turnout, it wasn't just, as you say, generic youth voters. Often it was in quite student areas, hence Canterbury, in Selly Oak. But it happens in quite ethnically diverse areas, which I think is why you say in places like Hodge Hill with Liam Byrne, the dictator of Hall Green, Roger Godsiff, you know, they were all getting like 75-80% of the vote. Whereas, as you say, places in Stoke where you've got your more kind of white working class, those kind of areas didn't go as Labour.
I think that's true, but I also think that we shouldn't kind of lose sight of the fact that Northfield probably does have very similar demographics, and we still manage to hold that. Some of the Coventry seats will also have similar demographics. And I wonder on those four seats, Stoke was always a very, very marginal. Stoke South, we lost?
Stoke South, we lost, yeah.
And that was always, what was his majority, Brian? It was less than 1,000, was it?
It was, yeah, it wasn't great. We've held those seats since the 30s, but they've been gradually...
The Mansfield and North East Derbyshire stuff, the reports I was hearing was really bad. And I think a lot of our colleagues nationally were hearing the postal vote returns from North East Derbyshire, which was one of the first ones we reported, saying it was in 2015, it was 60-40 Labour Conservative. 2017, it was 60-40 Conservative Labour. And I think, you know, the reverse of that sent a lot of kind of concerns running in nationally in that last week. One of the other narratives is about organisation on the ground, commitment and dedication to the candidates. You know, Richard Burden was a great candidate for Labour, and people of all kinds across the party were coming together to keep him in there. You know, we had our you know, big momentum crowds turning up for Richard, and we had long-term Labour activists, Labour loyalists, who really diligently running the campaign that they've always run, and coming together to do that was really important. Whereas I wonder in some of those seats whether actually the fracture of the Stoke party over recent years, that Walsall is, you know, something perhaps locally and certainly in some of the Derbyshire seats, the actual organisation of the ground game isn't as good as what it could have been.
But I think that's also true in Bolsover. You know, Dennis Skinner keeps hold of it with a large personal vote, but he almost sort of turns up in the pub with a megaphone rather than sort of door knocks, from what I hear. I mean, I've not been there, but that's kind of the feedback I hear from friends in the East Midlands.
His voice is probably that loud. It just
kind of... One of the kind of real challenges is, you know, where we're relying on personal votes and no work on the ground, a well-funded Conservative campaign that's able to use new technology, social media, but also to kind of flood resources into the area, but it makes us incredibly weak. It really does, because suddenly you've got, you know, so one of the interesting things for my campaign was the Facebook campaign, right? I've never run a Facebook campaign before. I now, you know, feel I could run any Facebook campaign. Such was my delight at taking part in this. But I ran, I got 350 likes for Fred Grinrod for Mid Worcestershire, which was brilliant.
Well, but it was me.
You know, still there to like, listeners, if you want to.
So we ran an ad, you know, very towards the end of the campaign. It really, you know, we could have done a lot more, but we didn't think it through. And Facebook told me there were 20,000 live profiles of Facebook users in the constituency. And it told me that actually of those, 10,000 might be interested in what I did. And we advertised it, you know, we got views of some kind by about 10,000 views on, you know, Facebook wise. And that was a very basic kind of campaign. And I think that if you're putting lots of money now into the digital campaign, it can start to deliver and chip away. And I think it worked for Labour. One of the things I think worked for Labour was really reinforcing Jeremy's message to a lot of our young voters. Right.
And I think also helps to counteract some of the Mail and the Sun, that traditional print media.
Yep.
Once the sort of narrative was being less dominated by the press, you get more of a hearing for prospective
you viewers. Do. And one of the things I think it really, the way social media kind of works, it really reinforces identity because of the echo chamber kind of concept. So it really worked for Jeremy far better than it worked for Ed Miliband. I mean, Ed Miliband did his Russell Brand interview thinking that he'd kind of reach out, and it didn't work. It didn't happen because Ed didn't look authentic to those people. But Jeremy really did. There was a real enthusiasm. So, you know, talking about Jeremy and the impact that Jeremy had on my campaign, is he inspired loads of people to come out and help me.
What is going to decide whether this is a sort of one-off flash in the pan or whether we can use it to build something much more sustainable long term, particularly around local elections, is how many of those activists, as well as those voters who came out for Corbyn rather than for Labour, if you see what I mean. So they came out in a general election campaign because they were coming out for Jeremy Corbyn, aren't really, you know, but haven't been coming out in the locals, in the mayorals and so on when he wasn't on the ballot.
Yep. And I think that narrative is all about the narrative we put about next year's local elections. Yep. If next year's local elections is part of the narrative to get rid of Theresa May, and this is a stepping stone on the way to do that, I think we'll be able to capture that. But yep. I think if Theresa May is gone by then, or the Tories have called it, you know, whatever, or Jeremy has lost his coalition, I think one of the things that we're talking about at some point was perhaps having a look at Jeremy's coalition that he's built, which is a really interesting coalition, really positive for Labour, but how do we kind of, you know, where's it all going to go and how do you keep it all happy is going to be really important.
The nice thing maybe that Corbyn's electoral strategy, which I think it was having that positive, those positive policies you could go out and vote for and want to go and campaign for. So you have students who go out and campaign for you because they want to remove tuition fees. Now, I think LJ and I, we've talked about how maybe if we were going to prioritise spending, we wouldn't go with tuition fees. But it's trying to find issues like that. And it's difficult, I think, to do that on a council level, given the austerity we're in. So I think that's one of the challenges probably that we have in the manifesto is trying to think, well, how can we try and motivate
that? And I think that's true. But one of the things I think that, it, you know, we, that is a policy. And whilst it, clearly it was an attractive introductory policy to Labour, campaigning for Labour, I think this election has left people who didn't vote, you know, didn't vote for Theresa May in a real feeling that she should have gone now if one more push. And actually, I think if we can capture next year's local elections as part of that, we don't necessarily need those specific local policies. And what we need is a feeling that this is about hitting the Tories, and it is becoming partisan now. And it would,
I think that, you know, a lot of them who did come out for the first time actually had a really good experience, right? I mean, it is scary the first time you knock on someone's door for the Labour Party, right? And they've sort of had this experience, and because of the way the result worked, it's been quite an affirmative experience, and hopefully that'll be, you know, back for more.
And I think you're right, LJ. Hopefully what this has done is realise actually campaigning works, and also it's about getting rid of those barriers, I think.
It is, and I think, you know, we in Northfield, there were some brilliant Super Saturdays where literally, you know, the organisers in Northfield would put up a table in the middle of Northfield High Street with loads of things to do, and streams of people would turn up, constant streams of people. You know, I mean, we're talking 100, and they go away. They were coming from, you know, all over Birmingham and the surrounding West Worcestershire areas. And it really was a sense of, you know, you bump people in, you know, and they'd be like, hello, I'm going out again. And this constant rotation of people. And I took out a couple of teams of activists on those Saturdays as kind of one of the known activists in the area. And I almost whole teams of people who'd never done this before. And the other interesting thing from, again, from my personal experience in Mid Worcestershire is we stopped campaigning at 5 o'clock in Mid Worcestershire because we knew that we had to go and help out in Northfield and help do the final push in Northfield. And we were my agent was getting calls like, Fred, we're going to Northfield, aren't we? Yeah, well, I've got this guy here who wants to do something for the Labour Party in Droitwich. Well, what can they do? Because we didn't do anything. We're not doing anything. And we would find them canvassing to go and do it. And they'd go and do it. Because they couldn't come to Northfield because, you know, they weren't able to do that. But so I had people campaigning for me throughout the day in the constituency who'd never done it before. And, you know, they'd turned up to volunteer to help, which was great.
One of the things, when we do go on to talking about Corbyn's coalition, that's going to be interesting is that an awful lot of places, certainly that I know of, Selly Oak, Northfield, Wolves North East, Gedling, various ones, we're looking at local issues and essentially saying, Corbyn's got no chance of being Prime Minister, so you might as well vote Labour. It's going to be interesting to see how well that coalition holds up when he does have a chance of becoming Prime Minister, whenever the next election is.
I think it is, but I think that such is the damage we did to Theresa May in that election, that the urgency for all of those people will be to get rid of Theresa May. And I think that's what we will find.
It's her we're up against. I'm not sure the Tories will let it be her.
But even if it's not, even if it's someone else, they'll have to pull some real stuff out in order to kind of
promote. It would be winning. It would be losing fourth election, which is equivalent to 97, isn't it? You know,
but
or 92.
The interesting thing is, in terms of say the Grenfell Tower, and you look at May's response to that, you look at Corbyn's response to that. I think that's genuinely the first time, apart from the campaign, maybe, but it's the first time since Jeremy's been leader where I've gone, he has genuinely reacted to that in a better way than Theresa May, and has reacted with his finger on the pulse. He's reacted better as a person and better as a politician and better as a leader and prospective Prime Minister than Theresa May or David Cameron, who it was before.
I genuinely looked at that and thought, is she actually secretly in the pay of the Fourth International or something? Like, yeah, I mean, you know, she's had the whole thing has been about she can't connect with real people, and then she did it. But then equally, you know, she's in a sort of no-win situation, because if she did go and connect with real people, they would have torn her to shreds, because there is no defending that. You know, literally, the cladding was put on Grenfell Tower to hide it for richer local residents. It was the cheaper stuff. It was £2 a square metre cheaper to put the flammable stuff on than the fire-resistant stuff on.
It is true, but at the end of the day, the responsibility for that lay with her ministers, with the Cameron government's failure to deal with the various fire regulations, and also Kensington and Chelsea Council. And I think, you know, there is a real issue there for me about how, you know, given the challenges that Birmingham City Council has been put under by the Departments of Community and Local Government, you know, for far less than what's going on there. And I do
there's lots of tower blocks. I mean, Druids Heath, for example, I know there's a lot of worried residents in Druids Heath about fire.
True, so, but I'm more about the fact that fundamental failures in Kensington and Chelsea Council, and I hope that we see significant investigations of that, and penalties where that's right. But one thing I think we've got to be really clear on is that a Prime Minister needs to be able to be in the place to lead the country. And okay, you might get abuse, you might know, but you got to do it. And the very fact of you doing it is something that people will give you credit. And you've got to be able to lead. And the fact she can't do that anymore really indicates that. And Jeremy has clearly proven, and I think this campaign has been good for Jeremy, because it's basically reinforced what Jeremy's good at and demonstrated how that is going to be a real key benefit for Labour going forward.
Reminds me of Emmanuel Macron actually saying that about having to, I think Marine Le Pen was doing a tour of a car factory or something in that final week before the runoff, and Macron went outside to talk to these people who were obviously quite sympathetic to Marine Le Pen and her agenda. But I think, I don't know if he got many votes from it, but I think the fact that he went down there and did it and had that argument, even though he wasn't going to win, I suppose it's about trying to get outside your bubble, maybe. Yeah.
And you've got to be able to, as a politician, you've got to be able to at least empathise with people, right? And that's one of the challenges that clearly Theresa May, you know, is a massive gaping hole in her competency, really. And I think that, you know, you've got to be able to go and cry with people. If you can't do that, then can you lead? I don't. And I think that's going to be, you know, the flaw. That's the flaw of her entire campaign, really.
Talking of gaping holes in Theresa May's incompetence, Not Enough Champagne on Sunday will be talking about the Brexit negotiations and how they're going so far. So that'll be an interesting listen. We'll be back with other Fabian podcasts as well.
Yes, so Birmingham Fabians is now on Facebook and on Twitter. Birmingham Fabian Society on Facebook and at Beham Fabians on Twitter. I'm also on Twitter with LJDavies87, Davies with an E.
I'm at Paperback Rioter.
And at Fred Grindrod.
We'll be back soon.